Welcome to Life on Less Meds, a podcast that reveals the truth about drug side effects and the best strategies to manage them. And now your host, Dr. Josef Witt-Dering.
Hi, I'm Dr. Josef Witt-Dering. It's my pleasure to be joined by Barb here. Barb is running the Benzo Warriors group, which is one of the most popular and longstanding groups for recovery from protracted benzodiazepine withdrawal. And she's kindly agreed to come on and share her story. She's had quite a lot of symptom recovery over the years, still is having some symptoms, but is feeling better. And so in some ways, this is a recovery story showing that symptoms do get better gradually. So Barb, thank you so much for coming on and agreeing to share your story with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So Barb, I'd love to start at the beginning just for context. How did you end up on benzos or psychiatric medication in the first place?
Yeah. So I was in my early 30s and I had dislocated my shoulder, which I'll start there. I have hypermobility. This stuff happens too easily, but that was kind of the beginning of it happening. So I had dislocated my shoulder, I think the second time. And I was coming out of an immobilizer and I guess my rotator cuff was injured, I think. Anyway, after coming out of the immobilizer, I started having really bad chronic pain. So it spread like across my body and down my trunk. And the next thing you know, I'm just like, I'm solid muscle spasms, like everywhere. You could see my muscles jumping in my back and it just wouldn't stop. And I was teaching at the time and I was on a sabbatical. I was doing research and I all of a sudden I just couldn't do it. Couldn't do anything. So the first thing that they put me on was a benzo. They put me on Klonopin as a muscle relaxer to try to kind of calm it down, I guess. And then they put me in, eventually they put me in pain management. And they just kept me on a benzo for 20 some years, like 23 wow. All told.
Okay.
And then of course there were other medications added. That turned into sort of a legacy of chronic pain, which I just had lived with. And so all kinds of medications got thrown at me.
Okay. What was the story of you coming off benzos? How did that begin and then happen?
So I should say this, maybe to be candid about it, it was not something that I chose. I did not realize that there was an issue. I had been told by many doctors, many different places, that this was just something that I would stay on for life. I had been to the Mayo Clinic, for goodness sakes, and had like my medications looked at and, you know, in other places, like told I was on an appropriate thing and would just stay on this for life. So then fast forward like 23 years, I had moved to a different state and I had to find a new pain doctor. And the new pain doctor, who was a neurologist, double board certified in neurology and pain medicine, did not want me on a benzo. Thought she did not want to be, as she put it, she did not want to be responsible for a problem that some other doctor had created. Mm-hmm. So her idea was to take me off. And I had no idea. I had no idea. So I just agreed to what she was suggesting. And at the time she was sort of like, she was thinking I was going to need pain management of some kind. And she didn't want to be prescribing whatever she would be writing for while I was on a benzo, I think. So I was like, you need to come off a benzo. So I agreed because I was, you know, I lived in pain and it got very bad, very fast. It was a rapid taper, got terrible fast. I was in the emergency room so many times and they didn't know what had happened. I got run around to all kinds of specialists trying to figure out like what had gone wrong. And one time, one person in the ER said, I think you're having benzo withdrawal. And I took that and I said, oh, okay. So I went back to the psychiatrist who had been writing for me before I moved. And I had a talk with him. I'm like, well, could this be what it is? So he tried putting me back on at, I think, three quarters of the dose. and symptoms didn't resolve. And we talked about it and we're like, well, we ran that experiment. That's not what it is. And so I kind of took what seemed like reasonable information and we went forward and we kept looking. And, you know, I kept looking with other doctors and I just kept getting up like, I don't know. But so meanwhile, I'm back on at some level. And then there are pieces of it that are a little hazy. I think at some point, another doctor put me on Valium. And so at the time, I don't know anything about equivalencies, but, in hindsight, I'm sure they must've updosed me quite a bit. And mm-hmm. that did stabilize me. And then they started tapering me off again. And they do the thing that psychiatrists do so commonly. And it was like half the dose and half again and half again. And I think they were making me do it like every 3 days. And well, I get absolutely terrible. Unable to walk, unable to drive, like literally unable to walk at all. And at this point I'm calling into the doctor. I mean, every day it's like a new symptom, right? And every day it's all kinds of scary. And I'm calling to the doctor. I'm like, this is happening. That's happening. And they treat me like I'm a freaking hypochondriac or something. And you know, now they have to have like boundaries because I'm calling too much. But meanwhile, I'm telling them stuff that's pretty serious. Like I'm telling them I can't walk, by which I mean I can't get off the couch and walk to the door even to like let 911 in. I can't walk. And I got nowhere with this. I was kind of begging for help at that point, and I was just kind of getting a brick wall. So they at some point wanted me to go to partial hospitalization program, and they were requiring me to do that or else they weren't going to keep me in their care. But they weren't hearing me when I said, I can't drive and I can't walk. I can't get there. Like I can't do the things you're asking me to do. It didn't matter. So I walked away. I walked away. I was like, these people are hurting me. They're not listening. I walked away. And then I ended up put back on like summer. I ended up with a new doctor who put me back on. I went like a couple of months and I didn't sleep, like 2 months without sleep that I was aware of. At which point you can imagine I'm just like beside myself, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm talking to like a new doctor and I'm saying like the only thing that ever made me sleep was like a benzodiazepine. I'm still like, I am not connecting with the idea of withdrawal. I'm a little dense, mm-hmm. but I didn't get it. And so this new doctor puts me on. And again, like that stabilized me. And I won't remember the exact dose or how it worked, but it did stabilize me. And so I had like maybe 6 months when I was able to like get back to work and walk long distances and stuff like that. And I was functioning. And then they put me in with a nurse practitioner to kind of like just do medication management. And at the time they had me on Seroquel. For sleep, because I had been in quite a lot of pain. I guess they just continued the Seroquel. And the new nurse practitioner says, well, she's worried about too much respiratory depression from being on Seroquel and a benzo. She's like, you know, we should discontinue one of these. And so she wants me to taper the benzo. And I'm a willing participant. I'm like, okay, like, if this is what you think, we'll just try it. And she cuts it too hard, too fast. And again, like all hell broke loose. And that's when I knew. That's when I knew. I'm like, oh, I had been through this hell before. And that's when I, you know, finally like my Googling benzo withdrawal finally connected. I think I came across Dee Foster's podcast on benzo belly and I was like, ding, 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 that's it.
A few questions here. How many months had gone by between your first rapid taper and when you found Dee Foster's podcast?
A lot of time. Cause like the first maybe year and a half, I wasn't even searching in the right category. So it was So it was two and a half years elapsed before I figured it out.
Okay. When you got back on the medications, did everything go away or were you still having residual symptoms?
When I...
Right before your last taper, when you found...
It went away. Okay. I mean, did everything go away? I don't know. I won't really remember to that degree, but it went away enough that I could function and live life.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So walk us forward from there. You're in a situation and they're trying to taper you again too quickly off the Valium. Yeah. You've just discovered, I guess, the world that is benzo withdrawal online, all of this stuff.
Right.
What year is this, by the way?
So now we're 2018, I think.
Okay. So it's 2018. What happened
2019. It's a little, I didn't anticipate going through this. So then I realize I'm in trouble. At that point, I realized that the benzodiazepine has been responsible for a terrific amount of damage. And, I did not know some of the stuff that I had underlying. Like I knew that I lived with chronic pain, but we called it fibromyalgia. I did not know that I had Ehlers-Danlos. I didn't know that Ehlers-Danlos existed. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't even have connected with the idea yet that there might have been particular risks for me coming off. Mm-hmm. So at the time I was just like, oh, well, this drug is really bad news and let's continue. But I needed to go more slowly. And to her credit, this nurse practitioner was at that point willing to let me control it. She was willing to let me go whatever pace that I needed to go. And I slowed it down a lot. I was already all kinds of destabilized. So I don't even know that it mattered a ton. She didn't know to restabilize me. But she knew to kind of, hand over the reins. And so at that point I just kind of continued at about 10% a month.
Mm-hmm.
And it took, I don't know, another year and a half to get off. And then I was on, so I had to remove Seroquel too, because I realized that was causing other complications. And at some point during the benzo taper, I just got rid of the Seroquel. I mean, I tapered it, but I I took that out, I think at the same time. And then I was still on Cymbalta, which is Cymbalta. They give it to pain people all the time, preferentially these days. Mm-hmm. It used to be that they'd have us on tricyclics for like neuropathic mm-hmm. kinds of pain. And then when Cymbalta came out, that was like the next greatest thing. And everybody got put on Cymbalta in the fibromyalgia world. So I'm like a year off the benzo about, and I'm in pain that is, I'm characterizing as like 10 out of 10 and then some probably. So I think like the Cymbalta can't possibly be helping. Like if you're in this kind of pain, like on Cymbalta, it can't possibly be helping. So I just sort of figured, okay, well, that's got to go too. And we'll see if that helps. So that was another taper too, is removing that one.
When do you think your protracted withdrawal injury really kicked off?
Yeah. Huh. I mean, I guess it was there that I was really seriously impacted shortly after the initial rapid taper. Cause even, well, what would you see? Like I went a few months, I think, before we had tried putting me back on then. And, the few months were pretty bad and then reinstated at that kind of three quarters level, it was still pretty bad. So things were amiss that early.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They just had abated, you know, at some point in that process.
And when did things really hit their peak in terms of severity of symptoms for you?
I guess the final taper that I did, the final slow taper, I was probably, they were pretty bad from the initial cut on that. Like the initial reduction was already, I stopped being able to drive. I stopped being able to go for walks. I stopped being able to work. So things had already gotten rough, but they did get worse. So I would say maybe 6 months into my slow taper or so, it just probably peaked and then kind of just stayed at, I mean, it was pretty unmanageable. It was just, there wasn't any help.
Can you just take us back there just for a moment? What was the day like when you were like 6 months into your slow taper?
I was barely able to get from my bed to my couch. I was actually living with my mother because I could not manage by myself, which she hated, but there wasn't, there weren't resources. I couldn't really get outside of the house. I was very, like my balance was terrible. My coordination was terrible. I must've looked drunk. I was falling and things like that. I had, for a while there, I had just insane levels of dizziness. But anyway, I wasn't getting around very well. And then that got worse with like mast cell activation and, my joints becoming very unstable. Then I really couldn't bear weight a lot of days. Like my knees were both pulling out all day long, a lot of days. And I like even a walker, it wouldn't help me. I couldn't bear weight. So I just kind of had to stay parked in a chair. Like I'd get up, I would get out of bed and I'd make it down to like a recliner and I would stay parked in the chair and I would get through the day. I would help out in Benza Warrior. I'd play board games a little bit. I listened to so many podcasts. I just kept my brain other places than how my body felt or else I wouldn't have managed. But I didn't do a lot.
So you had a lot of difficulty with mobility and joints. Yeah. What other symptoms did you have at the time?
I mean, I've always felt like I'm a little different than a lot of people. I was so much more intensely physical than what is typical. I mean, I certainly had other stuff. Like I had insomnia. I went through a long stretch where I slept at most every other night.
Oh my God.
I've been through more severe stuff. Like I had DPDR for a while. I had my memory just went gone. Like all of the short-term memory was gone for a while. I guess I would say I probably had anhedonia or at least, you know, pretty difficult depression. I don't know. I mean, who wouldn't with their joints flying out and being in insane pain. So, there were probably a couple hundred things, but I don't even catalog most of it. I kind of catalog the stuff that was the worst for me. And for me, like the neuropathic pain was mind blowing. It was literally mind-blowing. I mean, I've been a pain patient forever, right? And when you're a pain patient, every time you go into the doctor's office, it's like, can you rate your pain on a scale of 1 to 10? And it used to be we'd like rate our pain, it'd be like a 7 or an 8, and they'd want to do something. Well, this happened. And I'm like, now my pain's a 10, or at some point I'm like, it's a 25. And they're just like, okay, we don't care. Nothing to do, no comment, like how, you know, and the patient must be histrionic if her pain is like more than a 10, of course, or even if it is a 10 and you're likely you're alive, then you're histrionic. So you're whatever, it doesn't count. But neuropathic pain was terrible.
Where was the pain for you?
It's worse. I mean, it was everywhere. It was really everywhere. Like I have burning pain that's worse in my gut. It's kind of always constant in the whole torso, basically. But I had muscles spasming really badly, Every morning I would wake up and it would feel like my entire skeleton had like folded in on my spine and I'd be like this. Everything would be so clenched. And then it would get a little bit better during the day and it would just, you know, it would repeat itself. So the muscle stuff was really extreme, really extreme. And I couldn't get help for it. I certainly told the doctor who was tapering me. Of course I did. And she did not understand why it would be this bad. And then she didn't do anything about it.
Yeah. I talked to a lot of people and when this happens, they lose a lot in their life, you know, whether it's relationships, sometimes it's careers, sometimes there's a huge financial toll. And so I was just wondering if you could kind of unpack that a little from your experience. What was the cost to your life of this happening to you?
I mean, all of the above, of course. It's been years. Yeah. It's been, this started in, for me, it started in 2017. So, I mean, think about that. That's what we're having, year six or seven. And yes, much better, but I'm still dealing. I had stopped teaching a few years before because pain had gotten so bad. But in hindsight, I have to ask how much of that was mediated by the drugs too. I don't really know. I don't really know how different it would have been. So, but I can't 100% blame losing my teaching career on this, because that's a lot of that is like, okay, there is Ehlers Danlos, there is high impact pain, there's always going to be pain. And it's more of like, you know, how well does that get managed? But like, I mean, I had just moved into a new house, and like by myself in a new house in a new place, I couldn't manage any of it. I couldn't manage. I could not get around, and I'm by myself. So I had to sell the house. People, of course, like friends, didn't understand, I guess I would say I didn't get support, and I encountered the thing that people do, that they're sort of yelling for help and saying this is unbelievably bad, and people don't know what to say, and they don't know what to do, and it's not getting like a diagnosis that people understand, and so people just pull away. And that happened with family too. And I got my experiences had been so bad, like starting with the health system that kind of started this out for me. You lose a lot of trust. You lose a lot of trust in people. So as I encountered what were not helpful receptions, I stopped pushing it. I stopped asking for help. I stopped telling people. I found the groups, and I kind of focused my energy there at, you know, trying to do what I can to like stop this problem being so bad for people who are coming in, or, you know, help people at least know what was happening to them. I didn't want anybody else to go through what I had gone through, where they were going through this horrible thing and they didn't even know what had hit them. It was really important to me to be able to tell people, hey, we actually do know what is happening to you and why, and to be able to give them some information and to be able to give them people support.
What was the impact that this had on your mom as well? Because it sounds like you were living with your mom for some of this. Yeah. What was the impact of that on her life?
I mean, not good, really not good. It was, some of it was maybe mitigated a little bit by the pandemic, you know, things shutting down, and she really wanted to protect herself. So she didn't, there was a long stretch there where she didn't want to get out and see people anyway. Mm-hmm. And, but I will say this, my mom's not with us anymore. And it was the last few years of her life. Mm-hmm. And she, of course, didn't want me there. She didn't want to be dealing. And she could not cope. She really couldn't cope. My mom was high functioning, but probably, I think, on the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. And she could not handle feelings of any kind. She never really could. She couldn't handle an emotion. She couldn't handle me being in pain. It was always absurd, right? I'd been in pain half my life, but she couldn't hear the statement from me ever. Like, mom, I'm in so much pain. I need help. Like that was never something she could handle. So imagine like this person dealing with somebody going through, you know, benzo withdrawal.
Oh my God.
She couldn't cope. And so mostly I didn't ask her to cope. Mm-hmm. Mostly, I accepted the fact that she wasn't able to communicate or help or support, but I had a roof over my head.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was not a good thing for the last few years of her life.
Yeah. Were you ever worried that you weren't going to make it?
No, but how do I put this? There are worse things that can happen than not making it. I hate it when people use this word. I really do. But I feel that I was tortured for a long time. And I guess I think that that going on indefinitely, that's maybe worse than not making it. So it wasn't something to be afraid of. I mean, did I think it? Probably, but it wasn't something to be afraid of.
Yeah. What kept you going? Because that is what it is. It's torture for several years. How do you make sense of it? Being able to decide that's, you know, that you're going to just endure and carry on through this thing.
At first, when I realized, I was incredibly pissed off. I still am, but I'm not, I don't have that amount of energy attached to it anymore, but I was very pissed off and, angry at the doctors who had been involved, angry at the system, angry at the training. It was quite important to me to live through this, to be able to tell pain doctors in particular to stop doing this to people. You know, it still happens that people will be, you know, maybe they were on opioid therapy and they're on a benzo and they have the bright idea, hey, let's get rid of the benzo in the mix. And people get in trouble that way. And I just felt like it was coming at it from a different space than is maybe typical in the community, having come at it from pain medicine. I thought, well, like part of what I need to do here is be able to be there and tell this branch of medicine, hey, this needs to be done differently. And it never really was okay that the pain doctors weren't prescribing the benzo, but they were relying on somebody else and they weren't connecting the things. It was just a problem. So that was some of it, is I wanted to live to have something to do with calling attention to that. And then I think what I said before, that it was important to me that other people not go through this alone and not go through this unaware of what was happening to them. And I think I found purpose in, like that was something I had to give. That was something in which I kind of had a lot of insight and a lot of experience in ways that maybe not that many people did. And my brain was a little bit more there than some people. I was maybe a little bit less impaired and able to work my way around information and able to communicate it. And so, it was something to find purpose in, and that got me through quite a lot of days.
I'm going to segue now to start talking more about your recovery. Mm-hmm. Could you just walk me through, like, when did you start to notice things were just gradually improving for you? How long did that take?
So it unfolds so slowly. It kind of sneaks up on you, you know, almost the same way it sneaks up on you when you're taking the benzo in the first place. I noticed a few things really early on, like when I jumped off of, I had tapered Valium in the end. And when I jumped off Valium, I noticed a few things happen. Like I noticed mood brightening really kind of quickly. And I'm like, oh, whoa, this is nice. And I noticed this is kind of early after jumping, I noticed that some sleep functions started coming back. So I'd had tons of insomnia, but also for 20 years, at least, I had had non-restorative sleep. And I knew it too. I'd like gone and had these sleep studies done. They're telling me, like, basically, lady, you aren't sleeping. Like, you're not getting beyond stage 2 sleep ever, but they couldn't tell me why. And so anyway, after I jump, I started having dreams. I hadn't had dreams in decades, and I didn't know that, I didn't remember what it was like, you know, so I didn't even know it was not normal, but I started having dreams. And then And then memory started getting better. And then I started noticing that I was having restorative sleep, which I hadn't had in so long. That was like, that was a miracle. It was honestly a miracle. I could handle so much more than I had been able to just by getting, and it didn't even need to be many hours. Like it could be 3 hours if it was restorative sleep. It was like, I'm good to go. So that stuff happened kind of early. And then there's other stuff like my joint stabilizing that took a long time. It was probably 20 months along before, 20 months off before my joints started getting to be more stable. And I was, I think I was at 20 months when I, before I was able to go outside and walk in the yard. And I couldn't do much at that point, but I started doing laps in the yard. And I actually, even before that, there was a while, there was a couple of months before that where I was just making myself bear weight. I'd make myself like stand at the kitchen counter and bear weight. Cause I'm like, I'm going to force my legs to learn how to do this again. But then, yeah, then I started like doing laps in the yard. And then the next thing you know, I could go for a real walk. And so it's like a year ago about, I guess, that I started doing real walking. and that's been kind of steady improvement actually. So like, I'm not comfortable doing it yet. It's still not easy, but I enjoy it and I can go for miles. So, I mean, that's huge improvement.
That's great. Yeah. Did the pain resolve or is the pain still there?
So it's a little bit of a mixed bag. Like a lot of the spasming has resolved. Spasming, twisting, pulling in, all that stuff. Like that stuff is mostly resolved. I mean, every now and then I'll have neuromuscular stuff going on, but not terribly frequently. I am still in a huge amount of pain in the gut, like the entire nervous system is still terrible. So that's, I would say, still functionally limiting, but like not my legs, not my arms. I'm not in that place where I would say it's like, you know, a 25 anymore. I wouldn't even say it's a 10 anymore. I would just say it's like, it's functionally limiting. I don't like it, but, it's much better.
It's quite something to say, you know, I'm happy that my pain is, you know, it's not a 25 out of 10 or a 10 out of 10. It still makes it sound like it's like maybe a 9, you know,
and it's just like, I could live in an 8 and I'm good. I lived in an 8 before. It's all right.
Yeah. So how do you feel on a day-to-day basis? You know, just kind of where you are right now. Are you hopeful? Are the days gray? Is it a mixed bag? What is life like for you now this far along?
So there's a lot of rebuilding to do, which is, you know, with the losses this big, it's really daunting that you just like start getting better, but now you've got to put life back together again. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff. There's a lot of things, there are things that I couldn't handle. You know, like personal business stuff that I had a while actually where my vision was crap. I really couldn't see and I could barely read. So I listened to stuff instead, but it meant there was stuff that sort of requires vision and thinking and processing that I didn't have help with and couldn't do. So there's stuff like that that has to be addressed. So there's a significant amount of rebuilding. There is, what else? There's pieces that are quite enjoyable. Like, you know, I make a point of going on a walk for a couple hours or getting on a bike or something like that. And to me, I still get a real kick out of that. You know, I was housebound for a couple of years. So yeah. It's so cool to be out in the world and seeing things. That's, you know, I love it. Or last weekend it occurred to me there was this bulb show at the Botanical Gardens. And, you know, last year I wouldn't have been able to go to something like this. And I woke up and I'm like, oh, I think I want to go to that. And I can walk there as I just like pop up and go. And I'm so happy there, just like, you know, smelling the flowers. And it's an ordinary thing that other people do, but I appreciate it. You know, I haven't seen that stuff a lot. It's even like the scent is so strong. They have like freesias and hyacinths and some of these things are amazing to me. Little things are still amazing. Even I still get a kick out of going to the grocery store sometimes. I went a long time without going inside a grocery store. So just being able to see what's there and pick it out yourself and be with people, it's cool. So those things are good. I do still work in the groups quite a bit. In Benzo Warrior, which is a little different now than it was. I mean, it used to be something that kind of kept me going, and now there's quite a lot of responsibility in doing it, and I don't do it for me anymore. Mm-hmm. I do it for other people. Mm-hmm. So it's changed. And yeah, I'm hopeful. There's still a long way to go. It's still a little scary. I don't know. Am I going to be able to heal my gut so that I stop having these ridiculous reactions? I don't know. Mm-hmm. And, so I keep working on what can I do next? Can I make progress on this? And that's daunting. And it's still quite scary that allopathic medicine can't help me. And by now, I don't mean that they aren't trying or mm-hmm. haven't tried, because I did. Eventually I found a doctor who understood the Ehlers Danlos and who understood the mast cell activation and all that kind of stuff. So I found appropriate specialties, but they aren't really able to help yet. They don't understand the medication injury. I don't react well to medications. Even stuff as simple as an antihistamine, the antihistamines would really help a lot of people with mast cell activation, and they don't seem to be that helpful for me. So what's going on there? That stuff is daunting. It's needing to find any medical help, more through functional medicine, I think, than allopathic. To me, that's still a little scary. Mm-hmm. it's mixed, but I know from what I have done in Benzo Warrior, I know now that I'm able to put in quite a number of hours working and being useful. So that gives me hope. I can't necessarily jump back into the classroom, and not yet anyway. But there are things that I can do that are purposeful and, bring some fulfillment. So that's hopeful too.
You mentioned that there were still some things that you needed to rebuild. Was that returning to the classroom? Was that what you were talking about? Or were there other things on the list that you were alluding to?
Well, there's stuff there's all that time I wasn't circulating out in the world. So I don't have the social connectedness that one would expect to have in life. That's stuff that needs to be rebuilt. And I've worked on that, but that's just going to take time. Time and showing up for that kind of thing. The work world, something about the work world, am I going to try to get back into university in some capacity, mm-hmm. but I'm not quite ready for that. So,
What would you study?
I taught political science. Okay. But my brain is not so good that I'm ready to be teaching that again. But it's it's good enough for other things. There are university jobs that I could do. So,
okay.
Yeah, I don't know how that's going to flesh out yet.
Okay. Question about the Benzo Warriors group. What's mm-hmm. the best thing and what's the hardest thing about your work over there?
Gosh.
Yeah.
Good questions. Yeah. The best thing is definitely being in the center of people who get it and who validate each other and are supportive and caring. And I remember early on kind of having the sense when I found that group of this is my tribe. There are people, very empathic people. They're there to support each other. And there's truth in that. I enjoy being able to be with these people. I the sense of community. So like BenzoWare is one of the groups that aspires to not be a group. It aspires to really be a community. And I think it is. People get to know each other. They get to be friends. They, you know, we have a lot of ways in which people show up. We have Zoom meetings besides what goes on the Facebook and chats. And so like you develop friendships. And I think that's really important to get people through. So that's probably the best thing. What's the worst thing? The worst thing is that sometimes we lose people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's so scary and so heavy and there is injured people supporting other injured people. It's probably not how it would work ideally, right? And yet it's the system that we've got, and it's and there's a lot of good in it, but when things go badly wrong and you've got injured people supporting injured people, that's frightening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Bob, thank you so much for sharing your story. I want to give you an opportunity, you know, if there's something we didn't touch on or if there's an important message that you'd like to share, please go for it.
I think maybe the most important thing I would say is that people who are going through this, they do need to find community. They do need to find people who will validate what they are going through. They need to find people who are willing to talk ad nauseum about their symptoms. Like the people in their life, you know, in person, mm-hmm. they aren't going to be able to tolerate a lot of this stuff. They shouldn't really have to. Mm-hmm. So I do think like finding that support wherever it is, and it doesn't have to be like BenzoWarrior, but wherever it is, I think that helps people get through. I think having like a buddy or a few buddies that you're tapering with, that you connect with regularly, you know, that kind of keep a pulse on you and what's normal for you and when you're having a rough time and when you're doing well. I think that's quite important because it's not even possible that like the medical establishment will be able to adequately support people going through it. It's too intensive of a process. It's too lengthy. People are all kinds of dysregulated. You know, there's a lot there. The need for support is immense. Mm-hmm. So I do think that I think peer support is always going to have a role in that. And I think the other thing I would say is I hope that people who are going through it will be called upon to give back too, because that's kind of how peer support works necessarily, is that those who have gone through it step up and they give back to people who are, you know, coming after. I know that when people heal, it's really common to up and leave the community. And I do not blame anybody for wanting to leave the trauma behind. I really don't. But I think it takes a critical mass of people who are willing to stick around long enough to pass on what they have learned to the people coming. And there's a lot of knowledge to be gained from that. Honestly, like I have learned so much from listening to other people, listening to the videos, listening to, you know, interviews. I learned a ton from all of that. So I just hope that people will participate in that process and find their own gifts and pitch in.
Yeah. Well, Bob, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you want to see the full video interview, we also post these to YouTube. Just go to Wittering Psychiatry on YouTube to find those. You'll also find several YouTube exclusive videos from Drs. Yosef and Marissa posted several times a week. Finally, if you need help with your drug taper, getting a second opinion, or managing your post-acute withdrawal, come visit us at witteringpsychiatry.com. Our sole focus is on helping patients regain control of their lives and achieve optimal mental health on as little medications as possible.